The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Hey, good afternoon on this Tuesday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for your texts. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. I have to say, Greta Thunberg, I've been impressed by her for a long time now, but what she did yesterday in New York was hugely impressive and very emotional. She made that impassioned speech. And I would imagine people watching felt very uncomfortable. And I think to implement change, people have to be made feel uncomfortable. If we're not made feel uncomfortable or by our present situation, we'll just continue with the status quo. So we need people like Greta Thunberg to get up there and make those impassioned pleas for change. And she was just amazing, and she's on the cover of The Independent, The Times, The Examiner. I was just looking around at other publications. They're waking up, and well, they've woken up now over in America. So the Washington Post, climate outrage, teen activist Greta Thunberg scolded UN leaders who pledged bold action while protesters snarled. New York Times, foot dragging on climate aid as clock ticks. And within the article it says, the contrast between the slow pace of action and the urgency of the problem was underscored by the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, age 16, who excoriated world leaders for their business as usual approach. The eyes of all future generations are upon you, she said, her voice quavering with rage. If you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you. And the LA Times activists at UN say that they see little progress or urgency from leaders. In Germany, Die Welt, and there's a picture of Greta with the caption, we are the beginning of a mass extinction. Her home country, Sweden, has a picture of Donald Trump in the foreground and Greta Thunberg in the background. Greta's icy meeting with Trump is the headline there. And in England, only I didn't know this paper existed, called The Eye. None of the other papers pictured Greta Thunberg on the cover. The Eye did, and says, it quotes her, if you fail us, we will never forgive you. We are watching. I was looking around for an article on Greta Thunberg and her talking about her Asperger's. And I found an article from the beginning of September this year. It's her words. She says, Greta Thunberg has spoken about her Asperger syndrome diagnosis after she was criticised over the condition, saying it makes her a different, but that she considers it a superpower. And I was talking about a book the other day. We had him on 4 years ago, I think it could have been 3 years ago, a guy called Silberman, and he wrote a book called Neurotribes. And it's about that exactly. It's about how people with on the autistic spectrum are different and they have a lot to offer the world. He, for example, wrote an article, firstly, about the occurrence of Asperger's and autism in Silicon Valley. And he wrote it for Slate magazine. And then when he started investigating, he discovered that people who were on the spectrum were attracted towards certain jobs and had a certain way of working and a certain way of looking at the world. And it made them valuable to certain industries. And then that's why he wrote the whole book called Neurotribes. It's a fascinating read. And it's a very positive read as well. In this article, Greta says, before she started her climate action campaign, she had no energy, no friends, and I didn't speak to anyone. I just sat alone at home with an eating disorder. And she said she had not been open about her diagnosis of being on the autism spectrum in order to hide behind it, but because she knew, and this is her quote, many ignorant people still see it as an illness or something negative. She said, when haters go after you, your looks and differences, it means they have nowhere left to go, and then you know you're winning. While acknowledging that her diagnosis had limited her before, she said, it sometimes makes me a bit different from the norm. She sees being different as a superpower there. And she also says, it makes you think differently, especially in a big crisis like this one. We need to think outside the box. We need to think outside our current system. We need people who think outside the box and who aren't like everyone else. I just know what is right and I want to do what is right. I want to make sure I have done nothing, everything in my power to stop this crisis from happening to prevent it. I have Asperger's, I'm on the autism spectrum, so I don't really care about social codes that way. Yeah, just amazing. And as I say, like, she is making people feel uncomfortable. And for that reason, we hope there will be change. There will be change. I'm just looking there at a letter in the Irish Times, which is related to the whole thing. And it's from Angela Binchy from Kilcullen in County Kildare. Go on, Lily Whites. She says, Sir, while supporting grandchildren at last Friday's School Children's March for Action on Climate Change, I met other grandmothers, one of whom is intent on setting up an Action on Climate Change group for grannies. I hope she succeeds. Such a group would have the power of the ballot box, which most of these students do not have. There is usually a special relationship between grandparents and their grandchildren, and both generations together could put pressure on those of the generations in between who hold the power to do something immediately. Grey power. Scared of government before, and not all grannies are grey. Yours, Angela Binchy, Kilcullen, County Kildare. There you go. And on the generations in between, I see there's a survey released today about millennials and their attitudes to various things. It's the 2019 Deloitte Millennial Survey. And they have found that protecting the environment and climate change as their most pressing concern, which is encouraging. And then you read on into it, and then it says around 67% of respondents say that travelling and seeing the world is their top ambition. So they want to protect the planet and travel the world. You see, that's a bind, isn't it? And it's easy for our generation to say, because it's sort of, we've had our fun. I intend to travel a little bit more, but generally we've had our fun. And now a lot of the focus of climate change is on travel, particularly air travel. So those people want to protect the environment and they want to travel, so that's a bit of a bind. On less important matters, I see that more and more people are using emojis. There was a survey of 1,000 people. It found that more than 1 in 5 said they often use emojis, GIFs and memes, rather than words when they're online or using social media. And around 1 in 8 say they prefer using these to words. So that's the way the world's going now. We won't be able to communicate with words or face-to-face. It'll be all emojis. So you'll just walk around with some sort of device in your hand, camera, and then somebody will ask you something via that. Sort of a cake with a question mark or a coffee with a question mark, and then you just go thumbs up and you send it back. You know, conversations had. That's the way the world's going. On food, there's a good one. It's food and dating. It's a dangerous sort of area, isn't it? Like, I remember somebody once saying to me, never have spaghetti bolognese on your first date, because no matter how you try, there's going to be that whiplash of spaghetti that leaves the trail of bolognese sauce on your chin. You know what I mean? That's not a good look when you're trying to impress somebody. And then, so what's good to have on your first date? Should you go for a meal on your first date? Should it just be coffee? Should it be just a drink? Should you go to the cinema? All those things. But I remember a friend of my wife's telling my wife a story about one of her many dates. And the deal breaker was they went out for a meal and he ordered chicken wings. And all was going well and we were having a good old chat and laughing away. And then at the end of his chicken wings, he proceeded to ceremoniously suck the sauce off all 5 of the fingers, 4 fingers and a thumb on his right hand. And she said, no, thank you very much, not for me, I won't be seeing you again. Excuse me, as I mentioned the C word, yes, 100 days to Christmas and people are shopping for Christmas already. Somebody upstairs who remained nameless, Lisa, has most of her Christmas shopping done already. And the Kantar, who follow consumer trends in Ireland, their director, consumer director, Charlotte Scott, has spotted that supermarkets are selling stocking Christmas goodies and sales of chocolate box and gifts have soared 65% in the past month. So people are stockpiling. It makes sense though, doesn't it? It makes sense, particularly if you're on a tight budget. You know, you go and just every week you add a couple of selection boxes or a box of biscuits or a couple of boxes of chocolates into your weekly shop. And then before you know it, you've nearly all of your Christmas shopping done. Just like that. And you do it, spread it over a few weeks. It's better than saving. And then you're not hit with the big shopping bill when it comes to Christmas. Have you your Christmas shopping done? 51551ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. Back to black. And that was listed as number one in The Guardian's top 100 albums of the 21st century. Brilliant album. The saying, make me pure, but just not yet, applies to the whole climate issue, says Mike. Isn't that part of the problem with communicating the message? Is that it's in the future. It's in the future. And that's the human condition, that we like things that are just going to happen now. If we're in immediate danger, if there is a wild animal running towards us, we will definitely do something to get out of its way. Then if we're told that there's a wild animal coming towards us in a week's time, we'll probably sit in it for a while and then maybe do something about it next Sunday. And then if we're told that there's a wild animal coming towards us in 20 years' time, well, we go, ah, sure, I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn about the wild animal. It's only 20 years' time. So you don't get too head up about it. That's the problem, isn't it? I watched Greta last night in the news. I feel she should be in school and let the adults deal with climate change. I think she's a lightning rod for a message that a lot of people were trying to communicate but failed. And she seems to be successful. It's like Laura Brennan, which the HPV vaccine. Like, we had numerous people on this particular show telling us that people needed to get vaccinated, telling us that it was safe, all of those things. And still, the number of people who were getting their daughters vaccinated was going down and down and down. And then Laura Brennan comes on the scene with her unique message and her unique way of communicating it. And then suddenly, people take note. So you need people like Laura Brennan and Greta Thunberg in this world. And on less serious matters, on the sweet situation, I'm sure you'd agree that Christmas should be cancelled. Well, this isn't serious. Sorry, I'll get to the less serious one first and then that one. In all honesty, how many of those sweets are eaten well in advance and are replaced? A good marketing ploy, putting them on shelves now, said that person. And somebody else says, I'm sure you'd agree that Christmas should be cancelled this year for the kiddies so as to help beat climate change. It's such an appalling, blatant show of consumerism. 51551, ray@rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Cressida Cowell has joined us in Studio 10. She's the author of How to Train Your Dragon. There was a 12-book series, which have sold over 8 million copies. 3 movies.
Oh, yeah.
1 Netflix series.
Yeah,
And that was on CBBC as well.
Yeah.
So hugely successful.
I know.
And now you're on the third of the Wizards of Once.
The Wizards of Once.
Not three times.
Not three
third
times.
Trilogy. Now, before we do anything else, I have to thank you for naming our dog.
Oh!
You named our dog.
Really? Yeah. Which, Toothless or Hiccup?
No.
No?
You
no?
Have to go, no.
Okay, Stoic?
No.
Okay,
no.
I'm thinking out there.
Our
okay.
dog's name is Stanley.
Oh, that's fantastic to know. Emily Brown.
Emily Brown's little rabbit called Stanley.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yes, and we'd a vote in our house.
She's a character of some considerable splendidness, Emily
Brown.
She
is.
She gets offered all the toys you could ever desire. That's a big bribe. She says no.
By the cranky queen.
Yeah.
I've been recommending that book to so many people. It's such a brilliant book.
Oh, you sweetheart.
It's brilliant to have you here because of that and, of course, How to Train Your Dragon and all that. And I'm reading this to Tom, who's age 7, so we're only on about page 30, but he's enjoying
because
it.
That's fantastic because I write them to be read aloud.
Do you? Yes.
Deliberately, which is why I give Toothless a bit of stammer and I give Squeeze Juice, the little sprite, the sprite in Wizards of Oz has a sort of a hissy lisp, and it's to bring it alive. It's to make it fun for the adult reading it aloud.
Can I thank you for all on behalf of all parents, because it makes it easier when it's phonetically written, because I'm not too good at accents and all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
but I can read. So if it is written phonetically, it helps me
great deal. But the thing is, it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, David Tennant reads these on tapes brilliantly, but your dad making a fool of himself pretending to be Stoic the Vast of one of the characters, or I deliberately often set out to make the dads cry.
Right.
Because if a book makes your dad cry or your mum laugh, it sends this really important message to the kid that books are powerful, magical things that can have the power to make your dad cry or your mum laugh.
Yeah.
You know, and
loads of things to talk to you about. The book, the success of How to Train Your Dragon, it been turned into a movie. And your childhood, I suppose, is a good place to start, isn't it? Let's start at the very beginning. and it has coloured your life in a huge way, as it does all our lives. But this island that you used to summer on.
It always sounds like I'm making it up.
Yes.
And I promise you I'm not. I grew up in London in a house without a garden because my dad's job was in London, but he was an environmentalist. He was chairman of the RSPB, which looks after birds, and after he retired, chairman of Kew Gardens, which looks after flowers, and a good friend of wonderful David Attenborough. You were talking about Greta Thunberg.
Was he in your house?
He's a friend of my dad's. He's very interested in the environment, yeah, and wilderness. And what that meant for us as a family in practical terms is that every year from when I was a baby, we would be dropped off on an uninhabited island off the west coast of Scotland, an island so small that when you stand on the top of it, you can see sea all around you. Nothing on the island. No supermarkets, no roads, no houses, no mobile phones back in the 1970s.
Did you camp there initially?
We camped initially. And we would be dropped off by a local boatman and picked up again 2 weeks later. Yeah.
So this
unbelievable started, experience for a kid.
It sort of kick-started your imagination,
yeah.
Did it?
Yeah, and they were crazy. What were they thinking? I mean, you know, no way of contacting the outside world, but it was incredible experience for a child. And then from when I was 9, my dad had a house built on the island, and then we spent the whole summer there. And he got a boat so you could catch fish to eat, but still, you know, this is the Isle of Burke. And it was the first place the Vikings came to when they invaded as pirates, and then they stayed. And so there were real stories, you know, Viking stories.
Yes.
From the islands. And because there was no television on the island, my dad would, yeah, we'd read a lot, we'd make things up. It rained. It does rain in Scotland, a bit like an island. And my dad would tell us stories, Viking stories, and Vikings believed that dragons really existed. So that was the direct inspiration for How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Vikings in the movie version have Scottish accents.
That's why.
Oh, yes.
Because
they live in the Isle of Burke.
Well, because it was inspired by Viking Scotland.
Yes.
And so when the publishers were looking for somebody to read it on audio, they suggested somebody who sounded like me. I think they suggested wonderful Hugh Laurie, who is a brilliant actor, but I was already heard it in Scottish because of Viking Scotland. And so that's David Tennant. We were lucky with David Tennant.
Yeah. You're the children's laureate. And one of the things which I read about, which is a brilliant idea, and it ties into you starting to write as well, Free Writing Friday, this idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, just because I'm so glad you picked up on that.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is an idea where in schools that you have a copybook or whatever, and every Friday you're allowed time to just write a story. Yeah. And you continue it every Friday, but it's not marked.
A special book where you can write whatever you want and the teacher can't mark it.
Yes.
So they could write stories, they could write games, it's pure creativity. Some space for them to write whatever they want, where the spelling doesn't matter, the handwriting doesn't matter. It's all about the ideas. I think that's so important for kids. I go into school saying this, just 15 minutes where they can just, you know, an unmarked space. Because we need these children to be creative. You know, they need to know the rules, of how to write, how to read or whatever, but they need to learn to write for the joy of it. Yeah. They need to learn to be creative. You know,
Are you worried? When was the first time you went into a school as a writer? How many years ago?
20 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah,
so things have changed phenomenally since, haven't they?
Has it changed in Ireland?
Technology.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Well, in
and have you noticed that it's more difficult to get children to read?
Oh, I see, yes. Well, that's difficult because children are so smart, but reading takes a bit of an effort, yeah? I mean, you only have to watch an episode of The Simpsons to know how smart kids are. They want smart storytelling, but films and telly are beamed in magically to their heads, whereas books takes a bit more of an effort. Mm. So a book can very easily come to represent something that makes a kid feel stupid, even if they're not.
Right.
Even if they're not. And in my books, you know, Wizards once set in the Bronze Age, but Wish, who's one of the heroes, is dyslexic. And I did that very deliberately because I know how disheartening it is for a dyslexic kid. You know, it's not a race, but for a kid who's in that situation, they're so smart, but they're struggling to read or write.
And then
they've
been told by their parents and maybe their teachers as well that reading should be a joyous thing.
Yeah.
You'll never be bored if you read a book.
Yes, exactly.
All those things.
It's not joyous at all.
No.
But that's why I'm so keen for you to read aloud. I'm glad you are with your kid because then you can, you know, kids are often much smarter than their reading ability allows them to access. And I mean, I love films and television. I love them. I mean, I love the films that have been made out of my books, you know, because they're wonderful films. But we need to get the kids reading as well. Mm. And because, this is what I'm running around saying, reading is magic because of the magical powers it brings out that film and telly are not as good as bringing out.
Like
intelligence, creativity, and empathy. Yeah. Intelligence is the words. Yeah, all of the words. I mean, films are all about music and wonderful. I mean, I love music, but yeah, words, intelligence, creativity. A book is partly what I write and partly what you imagine. Mm. Film is very bossy. It's very directional. Empathy.
This is the important one for me,
yes,
I think.
This is the important one. Things on the film or a screen happen out there.
Yeah.
In a book, it's happening inside your head.
Yes.
You are that person. It's like walking around in somebody else's skin, to quote
Killer Mockingbird. You have to feel what they feel.
You have to feel what they
feel.
See
the world from their point of view.
Yeah. And so intelligence, creativity and empathy. If anything, we need children of the future to be even more intelligent,
yes,
creative and empathetic. And, you know, because some of the problems we're facing. I mean, and particularly in the UK where I don't know how it's like in Ireland, but we've been very focused on skills and less on creativity. And to quote Einstein, no problem can be solved with the same mindset that created it. We need children. Yeah.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Yeah, you know, that's why we need children. Greta Thunbergs.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And we need creative thinking.
Yeah.
We need creative, not just.
And when did you realise that writing was the thing you wanted to do? I know you illustrate your books well, and they're gloriously illustrated. And I love, you know, you have white on black, which is a real eye catcher.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm only allowed that. I do colour if they'd let me.
Yes. I'd say even white and black's expensive.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
Pushes
well,
up the cost.
Well, yeah, it's white and black, you know, it's quite nice to have been given that structure of it all being white and black. And it's amazing what you can do with...
But you have white out of black.
Yeah, white out of black. And yes, yeah, you've got that drama and the... It's dramatic. You know, these are dramatic stories. It's extraordinary what you can do just with pencil and ink. And I mean, I use pencil because that's a very child-friendly sort of medium.
And when you're, do you still write in a shed? Is that where you write down the end
I
of the
do,
garden?
Yeah.
You do. And when words aren't coming out, do you just draw a picture? Is that the way you do it, or do you write everything and then draw the pictures?
That's interesting. If I'm trying to get a feel for what the character is like, I will often draw my way into it. Or if I'm trying to do a new place, I'll draw maps. I mean, a map is a fantastic way of finding your way into a landscape. I mean, and it makes an imaginary place feel like a real place. That's why you'll find so many maps at the beginning of books.
Yes, and didn't I read somewhere, or I saw a documentary with Maeve Binchy. And
oh, yeah.
She used to plot out her book. She, like, if it was a fictitious place, wherever it was set,
yeah,
she'd draw out a map of the town and where all her characters lived.
Yeah, because you have to, it's making the life feel real.
Mm.
I mean, you have to imagine it as a real, because human beings are incredibly good at time and space and things like that. And so in order to make it feel real, you know, Maeve would need to know how long it took to get from one character's house to another.
Yes, and if two characters would meet each other on the way to the shop, for
exactly,
example, or whatever.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah,
it's treating it like it's all real. You know, Stanley Kubrick, I think, did a map of that really spooky old hotel, you know, in The Shining.
Oh, yes,
So it worked as a real place. So that the little kid, when he's going through the whole spooky hotel on his little cart, you know, that's
very spooky,
scary
scene,
little
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
It worked, you know, as a real space. You know, so... Yeah, so we often draw maps and draw our way into spaces.
I would never be able to write fiction, but I feel
you would.
No, I feel I've never heard it described
You've
like this before because
you.
I was watching a video you did, and you said, you know, writing fiction is like telling a really big lie. Yes.
A real stretcher of a lie.
Yeah.
The more detail you put into the lie and the more you base it on a tiny grain of truth, the more it comes alive.
Yeah.
Like we just said. And that goes for everything about writing. I mean, there's a posh word, research, which sounds so dull, but it, you know, is so interesting. Even when you're writing fantasy, I think research makes it feel real and gives you ideas for stories. So I'll do lots of research into real things, like discover discovered amazing facts, like in Wizards once, yeah, people really did think that magic was allergic to iron. So yes, they used to hang iron, horseshoes.
And one of the characters who is Wish, who's a warrior.
Oh, yeah.
She has a magic iron. She's magic that works on iron. Isn't that her, that's her thing? That's
you're
her
giving
superpower.
It away.
Sorry. Spoiler alert.
Yes.
Well, that was said in the first few pages. Sorry. I'm really sorry. Yes.
Don't worry. Yeah, she has the magic that works on iron, which is, yeah. But yeah, that's what gave me the idea. I'll discover just an extraordinary fact about Vikings. Like, I don't know, I read somewhere, this is probably made up, but it was, yeah, I discovered that Vikings trained cats so that when they were sword fighting an opponent, they could throw the cat at the opponent's head because it's very, very difficult to sword fight somebody when a cat is attacking you. That may not be true.
It is more difficult to fight somebody with a cat on your head. That happened in Viking times. Yeah. Now, Vikings and How to Train Your Dragon, like, how exciting was it to see your books and all these characters you've created on the big screen and done so brilliantly?
I know. I mean, that is beyond your wildest dreams. You're just not expecting that to happen, I have to say. You're just pleased you're getting the book published to start off with. For a long time, I didn't think they were going to do it. You know, lots of books get optioned, but, you know, it doesn't go. And so it wasn't until they optioned it in about 2004, 2005, and wasn't until about 2009 I thought, I think they really might make this, right. This movie. And I've just been so lucky. Yeah. I mean, the producer of all three films, wonderful Bonnie Arnold, produced Toy Story 1. Yeah. I mean, the director of all three films, director of Lilo and Stitch, you know, incredible. Sort of, and Lilo and Stitch was an amazingly inventive movie for Disney at the time. So these are really incredible people who brought a wonderful vision to the books.
How much input would you have now?
Now, people don't really understand this because they think that you must want to write the screenplay. Right. And I have always seen myself as a book writer. That is what I want to do. I think film is a different medium, and I was certainly not writing the books to be made into the movies. If I was, I wouldn't have written 12 of them. You know, and I think books are different things. My books are all about language, and they're all about idea. You know, there's a lot of ideas and work, you know. So whereas film is a more visual medium. In the film, you want the hero to be able to ride on the back of the dragon from the very first movie, you know, because it's a movie.
Yes.
It's all about, so I knew that changes had to be made, and I was open to somebody coming in, as long as they were wonderful, with a creative vision for it. And so they'll say, they'll send me a script and I'll say what I think, and, you know, so that's, and I'm very close to the filmmakers, and I have been. But I'm not writing the film myself. I'm not the screenwriter.
But Hiccup's such a brilliant hero.
He's
flawed, and he's, you know, he has a disability, and then Toothless isn't the full dragon either.
It's true to the spirit of the books. This is what the important thing is, I think. What I'm trying to do in my books is write books that move you. So books that make you laugh, but also can make you cry, are wondrous, make you feel the wonder of the world, and have a new kind of a hero who solves problems not by punching them.
Which his dad would have done.
Which his dad would have done. But by creativity. Yeah. No, those three things I was talking about, creativity, and empathy.
It's a common story as well, I would imagine, where, probably not so much now, but in the past it would have been where a son didn't live up to his dad's expectations, whether it be sport or whatever. And to see Hiccup then win over his dad, it's a beautiful thing.
Oh, thank you. It's a beautiful thing, and that's another true thing. I mean, I think, you know, that's a true thing that happens. I'm very interested in the relationship between parents and children, and I'm always exploring that in Wizards of Once. You'll know as well.
Yes, yeah.
Because often the parent is reading it with the kid, and it's just interesting to say. So I'm telling it, How to Train Your Dragon, from Stoic's point of view as well, the father whose son isn't quite what he expected. And yeah. I know as a parent how that can feel. So I'm that's an emotional thing. And I loved my father, but wasn't a bit like him. And looking up at this person that I admired so much, but I just didn't feel I was going to be able to live up to. And, you know, that thing, he was that generation. I think a lot of people resonate with this. He was that old-fashioned idea of a man who doesn't talk much about his feelings. Yeah. You know, I was this little chatty person, you can imagine. All emotions just very much on the surface. And I think that resonated for people. I think, you know, our idea of what a man ought to be, or what a boy ought to be, has changed.
Of course,
radically,
yes. Hugely,
yes. Hugely
for
in the
better.
Last 20, 30. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely.
But your dad was an environmentalist.
Yeah.
So he'd be, you know, following things. Is he still alive? Still alive? Or
he died last year.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Oh, my wonderful, wonderful dad.
Oh,
what a one! What a wonderful man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like Greta Thunberg and what's happened currently with the, you know, climate change and the protests and.
Well, you see, you will notice on the front cover of Wizard Once, Not Three Times, Sycorax, the forests are on fire. And Sycorax has set fire to the forest. I mean, this takes place in the Bronze Ages, so yes. I'm sure it's a total coincidence. But she has set fire to the forest, the Wild's Wizard, so that she can build her forts and her fields and her new modern world.
Right.
And completely coincidentally, in Brazil,
yes,
the forests
the Amazon
are burning.
Forest, yeah.
Even now.
Yeah. Would you be hopeful? What age are your children?
My children are 20, 21, 19 and 16.
Right.
And I'm not surprised. I'm interested. I was listening to you talk earlier about, I'm not surprised that Greta, I mean, we have David at the other end, David Attenborough,
yeah,
at the
in
end
his
of
90s.
A long life speaking out. I'm not surprised that it's a child who's spearheading this, because one of the things, and one of the reasons writing for children is so wonderful and is one of the best things, is that children believe in the impossible. They believe in the impossible because they don't know the rules yet.
Yes, yeah.
And it's their belief in the impossible, I think, because I'm essentially a very hopeful person, it's their belief in the impossible that just might make it happen. Yeah?
Yeah,
so
it's sort of
turn away from the impossible. Mm. They think it's impossible, we can't do anything about it. But I'm with Greta, I'm with Einstein. You believe in the impossible. Knowledge, this is Einstein again, knowledge is limited, imagination encircles the world. It's the
Give us your first Einstein quote again there.
Oh, which one?
Knowledge limited.
No problem can be solved with the same mindset that created it.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Isn't it?
It's a good one. It's a hopeful one.
Yeah.
We're relying on bringing out these children's creativity and inventiveness.
My son Sam's a huge fan of How to Train Your Dragon, and he's asking me, how did Cressida come up with the names of the dragons, like Night Fury and Monstrous Nightmare, etc.? Sam writes lots of comics too.
Oh, does he? Oh, keep going, Sam.
How do you come up with the names, Cressida?
Oh, yeah. Well, Night Fury, by the way, is one of the ones that the film company came up with. They came up with good things as well. Monstrous Nightmare is one of mine. Vikings really were called extraordinary. This is where you go back to research, giving you ideas. Really were called extraordinary names, like Magnus Barelegs and Ivar the Boneless.
Right.
Those are real
Vikings. Yes. Yeah.
And so I suppose that gave me the idea of giving
there.
The names.
Giving
them names that sort of described, you know. So there's one of the characters, one of the Vikings in my ones are called Baggy Bum the Beer Belly. You know.
Right.
And, and so the Vikings are called the dragons are called similarly. Very descriptive.
Yeah, colourful names. Now, you're on your way up to Easons in Dundrum.
I am.
To do a signing.
I am.
The Wizards of Once, Knock Three Times. It's the third book in the trilogy. And this has been optioned for... Where is it at? Is it going?
Well, it's DreamWorks, because they did such a wonderful job with How to Train Your Dragon. Yeah. So, yeah, they've been optioned.
So we'll see Wish and Zara on the big screen sometime soon.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. Well, it's been a real pleasure meeting you and talking to you.
It's been so lovely.
Thanks, Chris McCall. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
So, Easton's in Dundrum, you're there from 4 o'clock for as long as it takes.
Yeah, I'll be there. I'll sign anything you bring in. Right, <yeah.
laughs> Thanks, Chris, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Cressida Cowell. A lovely lady, and that book that I was recommending to people that I met, which was hugely popular in our house over the years, written by Cressida, that rabbit belongs to Emily Brown. It's a very sweet book, and it's a lovely book to read at night. And her current book is The Wizards of Once, Knock Three Times, and she's on her way up to Easton's in Dundrum to sign copies of that. Now, on things we were talking about, early dates and meals, what to eat, what not, I'd be more inclined to point out that wine, if not used to it, might be worse than food. An aunt of mine, on her second love after her husband died, had a little too much red. Excused herself and rushed to the loo with a smile of worry. While getting sick, her teeth ended up being flushed away. My word. I know you're wondering, did he stay around? He did, bless him. And they shared many years of love and lipstick. True story. That's Computer Mal. Thanks, Computer, for that. Computer Mal. When I went on one of the first dates for a meal with my now husband, I decided to order a chicken salad so as not to look like I was a hound. The salad came out on the biggest plate I'd ever seen with almost a whole chicken on it. I nearly died with embarrassment, but it broke the ice for us and we still laugh about that meal today, says Helen. And on climate change, and Greta Thunberg, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, as they say. So I hope Greta and her followers lead by example and throw out their phones, laptops, etc., including flying. Otherwise, one can take all these marches with a grain of salt. Well, Anna, it's a collective thing. It's a global thing. We all have to do it together. It's not about pointing the finger at somebody and asking somebody else to do it. And we have to have leadership from our governments because we can do our own little bit, compostable this and compostable that. But unless the governments make the tough decisions that we all have to follow, well, what we do doesn't matter for much. Now, Pier Street Library in Dublin is going to get a hell of a lot noisier thanks to a new project that will allow teenagers to borrow musical instruments for free. I'm joined by Gillian Colton, the senior librarian at Pier Street Library. Afternoon, Gillian.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good. I heard about this. It was mentioned on what it says in the paper yesterday, and I thought that's a brilliant initiative. So tell us about it.
Well, it is a brilliant initiative because I think it might be one of the first ones to target teenagers. We have, and other libraries in Ireland have lent out musical instruments for the past few years, because it's not all about books, as you know, because you've talked to librarians a lot. So, yeah, we have a great partnership with Girls Rock Dublin, who are a fantastic non-for-profit, volunteer-led organisation, and they seek to kind of build self-esteem through music creation and performance. And they came into us in the library, and I just thought, wow, they're similar core values to the library. Mm. They love sharing resources, which we're all doing now, that we're trying to have a greener society. And they value diversity and inclusion and building leadership through and team building through culture and learning. So we're like, yes, please, and let's work together.
Okay, so did you go out and purchase a selection of musical instruments, or what happened?
Girls Rock Dublin had put out a call earlier this year for donations, and they received great response from people that value their work, and they also got funding from reverb.com to purchase new instruments. Mm. So we have a massive range. We've got basses, we've got some nice electric guitars, some Fender Squires, and we've got acoustic as well. We've got everything from a waterproof ukulele that you could take out surfing with you.
A waterproof ukulele. How did that come about?
I know, there's a few crazy things. We've got the biggest tambourine I've ever seen, and a glockenspiel. We've lots. Apparently surfing with your ukulele is a thing.
Is it right?
Who knew?
And this is close to your heart as well, because you played a musical instrument when you were younger.
I did. When I was younger, we got a chance in school to have a go at the violin and the cello, and I fell in love with the cello. I love the sound it makes, and I still do. I think it adds so much to music. But then when it came to it, and the music teacher said, you're getting good at this, let's take it to the next level. And she said, well, do you want to go ahead and buy an instrument and, you know, do more lessons? And I was too scared. scared to ask my mum and dad to buy it. I thought it's too much money. So that's why I think it's great if there are kids out there who have, you know, a love of music and they've maybe tried out an instrument and they'd like to just have another go. This is free. Yeah. And
how much are we talking about just on your story? Like, I know it was a few years ago, but how much would a cello have been back then?
I don't know. Is it like probably 400?
All right, yeah, it's expensive,
This is back in the 90s, so I couldn't have asked them for that. And, you know, we've talked about it since. They're like, you should have said something. I didn't even say it to them. I was too, felt too guilty. So I hope that we can reach kids like that who maybe don't have the means. I mean, it's a lot of money to invest in an instrument, especially if maybe, you know, they might pick something else up and there might be another hobby that catches their fancy after a while. So at least now you can borrow them for 3 weeks at a time. And if no one else is looking for it, we can renew 2 times. So 9 weeks, potentially.
Right. Okay. And which is enough time to see if you like it or if you have an aptitude for it or a talent for it. Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So so you go in and you go, how are you? how are you, Gillian? I'd like to take out a set of drums.
Yes.
And what happens then?
Well, we say, have you got a big car? once you have a young adult card in Dublin City Libraries, which is very easy, all you need is to fill out the application, either online or in the library, bring in a parent or guardian, and they'll just sign the form for us.
Right.
And they just need proof of address and ID. And we know that can sometimes be difficult for people. So if anyone has trouble getting proof of address, they're just give us a call or an email or pop in. We're friendly and we're, you know, we try and reduce any barriers to joining.
Okay. And do you think, Gillian, something that libraries around the country could replicate?
I mean, I know for a fact that Cork already lend out instruments, and when I was cataloguing the instruments, I was like, oh gosh, Wicklow have instruments too. You know, I could see that other libraries
have them.
And our music library has been lending out ukuleles and guitars and violins and running like workshops in songwriting, GarageBand, which is software that, you know, you can record on. And they've been doing that for a while. So I think there is a musical element in libraries because they recognise the importance of music for things like team building, but also for your brain. Even, like, you know, musicians are better at multitasking, they say, and that it helps with your memory and even your reading skills. So we would do music with, you know, everything from toddlers up in the libraries. And I think it is across the board. And we have Ballyfermot Library is currently getting a creative studio. It's a recording studio with 2 recording booths.
Isn't that very exciting?
So, podcasts and for recording. Yeah, so we're trying to, I suppose, and it's something, we have a lot of children and preschoolers in the library, and then teenagers, not so much.
So you know, it's to lure them in.
Yeah. And it's so good to see them in, because we had an event on Culture Night, and it was just inspirational to see these whippet smart teenagers come in, and they spent 20 minutes on the instruments, and then at the end they played Seven Nation Army and did a cracking job. It's up on our Facebook page. We've all been humming it.
Somebody asked, can boys borrow the instruments as well? Because they're girls rock stubborn.
Absolutely. Okay. We're open to all genders.
Brilliant.
And
Gillian, thanks so much. And that's Pierce Street Library, who are now lending out musical instruments, and it might be happening in a library near you, so just pop in and ask. Gillian Colton, thanks very much. Thanks,
cheers,
Gillian. Bye, bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551 or ray at rte.ie. Now, Colin Harmon is in studio with me. He's a 4-time Irish barista champion and has been a well-known name in the coffee business in Ireland since opening his first cafe in Dublin 10 years ago. And you have your own coffee, do you? Your own brand of coffee?
We have a roastery, yeah. So we roast coffee.
Roastery, right.
In Glasnevin. So this year we'll roast about 120 tonnes of coffee, send it all over the world.
Right.
Yeah. I'm still getting used to it as well. So
the raw material comes in from another country, obviously, and then you add value to it and then
And off you go. Yeah, like, so my business partner, he has the, it sounds very exotic and wonderful, but he travels around the world probably 200 days a year sourcing, like, at the farm gate, sourcing the best coffees we can get our hands on. And then it gets over here and then we make it, you know, we turn it brown and put it in bags and off we go. So it's, we try to find really good coffee, work directly with farmers so they're getting really good prices, build relationships and...
You and your partner do all that hard work and you package it lovely and all that, but does a lot depend on the person who gets that... And the machine, therein, like, and the type of water, and you know, all that stuff.
Oh, like it's soul destroying because, like, you could that bag that you're holding in your hand. Okay, now this is one's a higher end one. That's €22 bag. That is expensive.
Come on.
Yeah, I know. Now you can get cheaper stuff as well. They're not all that price, right. But. If I bought you, which I didn't, but a really expensive bottle of whiskey, you go home, just pour glasses of it, and it's excellence every glass. Brilliant. Okay, done. With coffee, you could bring that home, you could make an absolute mess of it.
Yes.
And it would taste terrible. And that is why I work in coffee, because it's the most frustrating, but also the most rewarding part of it.
Yeah. So we have, is it when they're plotting the relationship between Ireland, the Irish nation, and coffee, where did the change start? Is it 20 years ago? Is it?
I think Bewleys are definitely responsible for a lot of the good things that happened in coffee over the years in Ireland. And I mean, they were, as far as I know, originally a tea company.
Yes. And we were a tea nation, though, weren't
we?
Yeah,
still
are. We're
very
much a tea nation.
Still are. And I think definitely, I mean, I have a friend in San Francisco, Trish Rothkeb, who's credited with talking about the waves of coffee. So you've got the first wave of coffee, which is just basic, you know, coffee is available to people around the world. The second wave is kind of like the kind of Italian way of serving coffee. And then the third wave is the more modern kind of like farm specific, process specific way of brewing coffee, all that kind of, I suppose, what you might call hipster wave. Kind of stuff. It's in Ireland, I think, definitely when we started 10 years ago, what I would consider really good coffee was, I suppose, thin on the ground. But today we could go to 30 coffee shops in Dublin, you know, there'd be, you know, a few in Galway and Cork, and, you know, they're popping up in all the small towns around the country. So I don't think people in Ireland appreciate, I travel quite a lot for coffee business, and I don't think people in Ireland appreciate just how good we are in terms of serving coffee in comparison to other countries in the world, you know.
All right.
So it's the difference in the last 10 years is incredible, and the World Barista Championships came to Dublin in 2016. And the people that came were like, I can't believe the standard here. It's unbelievable. So we're blessed with, especially in Dublin, we're blessed with two things, is excellent quality milk and excellent water.
Ah, and they're the main ingredients there. Well, they're two of the three main ingredients.
Well, if I make you, if I made you a cup of filter coffee that you can, you know, buy in the shop, whatever, like a French press or something like that, it's about 98.6% water.
Right.
So it's kind of important.
Yes, yeah.
And soul destroying at the same time. We could go into it, but it would be hours, you know. So
you did something else out of college, did you?
I did business and law.
All
and
right.
Then I got a job after working in the IFSC for an investment bank called Cassa East, who are really good people, and, you know, had a wonderful career mapped out in front of me, but it just wasn't for me, you know. And
so the hospitality itch was something you had to scratch.
Yeah, well, like, I've always worked in, my first job was in McDonald's in Grafton Street. Back when that was, you know, when people didn't have mobile phones. I was trying to explain this to the staff recently, that that's where you went to meet your friends.
Oh, yeah. And you had to be there.
Yeah. At that time, whereas you wandered the city looking for them. And so it was the centre of the city and it was rammed all the time. And I just got bitten by the bug. I was just like, this is what I want to do. And so I was working in bars and restaurants and cafe all the way through college. And then by the time I got a proper job, I was like a year into it. And I was like, oh, no, I want to go back to that thing. That was much better. So at the time, things were booming. So I said, I'll give myself a year. I'll take a year out. And if I can't figure out a way to make a career out of working in hospitality, I'll come back. And in those days, a lot of my colleagues were taking a year out to go travel to Southeast Asia or whatever. Mm. And they come back and they give them a pay rise and say, oh, I'll take your old job back. You know, so I said, there's no risk here. There's no risk. So, of course, I quit my job, got a job working as a barista. 2 months later, the world economy collapsed, so it wasn't going back. But a year to the day...
You were sort of stuck.
Exactly, yeah. But a year to the day after I finished, or that I started working as a barista, I was in the finals of the World Barista Championships, and I finished fourth. And I went, you know what, there's something in this.
And there's more to barista than just making those fancy decorations on the top of a cappuccino.
Oh, infinitely more. I mean, we could bore you to tears, you know. And we often meet people and say, I just want a simple, easy, cheap solution to make great coffee. And I'm like, so do I. And when it exists, I'll give you a shout. But there is so much you can go into doing it. And it's relatively easy to make okay coffee, and it's incredibly difficult to make great coffee.
And what defines great coffee, Colin?
Well, that's the other thing, is that's subjective.
Yeah.
So, I mean... It's different things for different people, you know. But I think freshness is, to me, is one of the most important things. Having fresh water, freshly grinding coffee, having a fresh crop coffee that's freshly roasted, all of those things mean it's a...
But the taste, should it be smooth or bitter?
Depends on the origin, you know. So if you get a really great Brazilian coffee, it's most likely going to be very chocolatey and nutty and smooth. And this coffee is a variety called Geisha, which is incredibly rare, hard to grow, incredibly expensive, as I've already gone through.
How is it affecting the planet?
Well, I mean, it's problematic in every sense, you know, with all things. But it's definitely, this coffee would probably taste more like tea to you than it does coffee.
Right.
And it's not for everybody, but it's definitely more experience-led, you know?
Whenever you're chatting to people of a certain age, and I'd be the same, like, people do have a dream about setting up a cafe or a B&B. Is there something in us as humans that we want to mind people, entertain people, give joy to people through food and coffee and tea and cakes?
I think it's definitely with Irish people. I think there's a sense of hospitality that's with us all. We just like making people happy. And I think when I worked in finance, I'd go on holidays with my wife, and I'd be great to this. And one day she just snapped and she's like, either do it or don't.
She said to you.
Yeah, and
right.
I was like, right, I'll have a crack, you know, so I blame her, and off we went. But it's definitely, I meet people all the time, get emails and people, messages on Instagram or Twitter or whatever, saying, oh, I've always wanted to open a coffee shop.
Yeah.
And it's definitely one of those things where, like, people say I always say why, and they say, well, because I love going to coffee shops and I love coffee and all. I'm like, we should keep doing that. Because, like, when you're on the far side of the counter, it's a different experience, you know? Yeah. I mean, I like going to the circus. I don't want to dress as a clown, though, you know what I mean? So it's a completely different thing. So if you like doing that, keep doing it, you know?
You've written this book, and it's a few years old, and you're currently working on the follow-up. What I Know About Running Coffee Shops. And you're telling me before we went on air that a lot of people read it and actually decide not to open a coffee shop.
Yeah. This was a college project.
Right.
So I did a master's in UCD and they said you have to launch a business, and they wouldn't let me use the one I already had. So I said, I'll do this. And it was kind of just like a coffee shop. I think people often say, I'd love to write a book. So I said, I'll do that. It'd be fine. I had some money put aside from another project. I said, I can use that for the... So I self-published it and self-distributed it. I think to date, including all the translations, we've sold about 27,000 of them. And then there's the ebook as well, which I've completely lost.
It's a handbook, is it? It's a handbook to sell.
Yeah, but it's made for people also that don't want to run a coffee shop. I've met architects and plumbers that go, I got an awful lot from that, you know, because I read books about cyclists and whatever, drummers, or any sort of profession. I'm interested in processes.
Right.
And I think definitely there's a large chunk of society that at one stage, whether it's 5 seconds or 5 years, strongly consider opening a restaurant, a bar, or a cafe. And it gives them, I suppose, in...
A reality check, is it?
Yeah.
A reality check, yeah.
But like, the thing is, though, I've met people that have said to me, oh, I read the book, I always wanted to open a coffee shop, and now I'm not. Right. And I'm like, that's a very cheap way to find out.
Yeah.
So it's
what's
been
the failure? I remember reading your man's book, the guy who died last year, Anthony Bourdain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
His first book, Kitchen Confidential, was something like...
That had a big impact on me when I read
it.
And it should have dissuaded me.
It should, yeah. It was something like, I don't know, 70% of... restaurants or whatever.
Oh, restaurants
fail.
Are even worse, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think a lot of people, like, they have unrealistic expectations of what it's like, and I see it almost as a lifestyle choice, but it's tough, you know. And I think especially this year, a lot of Irish cafes have found it difficult. The business environment isn't great. There's a lot of hesitancy around Brexit, and you know, people are...
And we're hearing
there.
About insurance, and is that
yeah, and it's like insurance costs are going up, and rents and rates and all that. I mean, like,
so before you open the door or sell a cup of coffee
or even the chance to exist in the first place, like when I opened up, I was given, like, a good friend of mine, Trevor O'Shea, who runs Body Tonic, essentially gave me the lobby of a nightclub, which doesn't sound like the best place to open a coffee shop, but he said, there you go, if you make money, you can pay some rent. If you don't, what have you lost? And then, like, you know, 10 years later, we have 54 staff and 5 locations at the roastery. So without him doing that, we wouldn't have existed. Now, he also owns the Bernard Shaw, and they're getting closed down now. But they've acted as an incubator for countless businesses in the city that started off with just like maybe a stall at a car boot sale or something, or a space
upstairs.
And what
will happen with Bernard Shaw's now? The
hotel.
A hotel, is it?
Yeah. And like, I've nothing against that, and there's lots of people coming to the city and we need to look after them, all that, but there needs to be creative spaces.
But they need places to go then, don't they?
Well, my shop, when I open, if I tell you, if you give me a shop with a 30 grand a year rent or something starting off, I would have absolutely crashed and burned. When I opened up, I had a counter, an espresso machine. It was just me. I sold 16 cups of coffee on my first day. The next day I sold 17, and I built it up slowly. And I was like, I had a business degree, so you'd think I'd have some sort of acumen at this. It was a disaster. It was an absolute mess.
Right.
And as it grew and grew, I got to learn. It was like a sandbox for me, you know what I mean? And people need those sort of spaces so they can grow businesses because a high street shop
was sort of utopian, isn't it, Colin?
But it, I mean, it is, but at the same time, it happened, and I can
yeah, it happened with you, but yeah, it was a different time, I suppose. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think the people always say to me, like, what was it like starting in a recession? I was like, it was brilliant. People wanted to do work, you know, you could get a plumber,
all that kind of stuff.
So it's different now.
Away from the coffee and your personal story, you've three children, but you had four. Is that the way you're looking at it? What way? Because people, when these tragedies happen to them, they have a different ways of talking about it.
Yeah, so myself and my wife, that we consider that we had four kids.
Right.
And I think an awful lot of the time to spare other people's blushes, you're like, you don't want to embarrass people, because we're fine talking about it, you know, it's difficult, whatever. But if you say to someone, well, we had a fourth child and but they didn't make it, the people get they get embarrassed, and they, you know, sometimes they get upset, they get more upset than you do. Mm. I mean, it's socially awkward, I suppose, but yeah, we always consider that we had four, you know, but it becomes a private enough thing, you know. So for most people we have three, but for us we have four, you know.
Yeah. And it was identical twins. Oisin was his name. Yeah, and so what happened? It was the second pregnancy, second child.
We found out we were having twins, and it was it was a bit of a shock, but we were getting ready for it. And halfway through the pregnancy, or a little earlier even, we found that they were suffering from what's called twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, which, and I'm sure there's a better definition of it, but when identical twins share a placenta, there's blood flow between the twins, and sometimes that blood flow becomes uneven, and one of the twins gets more and one of the twins gets less. And my wife went through a procedure with a laser to try and, you know, I think cut some of those capillaries to even up the blood flow, and that didn't work. So we lost one of the babies at 26 weeks, and we're told that the other one, you know, his days were numbered. And I still remember going back a week later, you know, just to hear the full bad news, you know, and the doctor looking at the screen and going, oh, there's something happening in here. And then every day we went back after that, he got better and better and better. And Dallin is his name, and he's thankfully thriving today, you know. So we're delighted to have him, you know. But we still miss Oisin, which is a weird thing because you've never met him.
Yeah.
And but still a big part of our lives. And the kids know about him, they talk about him, and I think that's important as well, because you have to normalise it.
So Dallin's five, and he knows that he had a twin brother.
We went to see a bereavement counsellor, and they were saying, you know, like, what causes hassle in a lot of families is secrets. And when you find out something that's a secret, it can cause ructions down the line, you know. So we decided quite early on that we'd tell him. And when he told him, he didn't really understand, you know. And but he brings it up quite often. Sometimes he brings it up in situations where he's, you know, just he'll tell people on the street, and they don't know how to deal with it, you know, which can be
out of the mouths of babes.
Yeah, yeah. He knows it's there, and he knows it happened, you know. And we try to be as open as possible about it, because I think that's the best way to be. But, you know, it's easier to be open with it with kids than it is to be with adults, I think, sometimes, you know.
And grieving that, because, so I'm just trying to get my head around the sequence of events. So you would have had your scan at, your wife would have had your scan, what's your wife's name?
Yvonne.
Yvonne would have had her scan at 12 weeks and would have known that it was twins.
Mm.
So you tell friends and family.
Yeah.
That you have twins, yeah.
And I think that's in my line of work, I've got quite a public persona to a certain extent, but I'm also, like, realistically actually quite a private person, and wouldn't really discuss a lot of this with people. But we kept bumping into people. It's like, oh, how are the twins? And then you have to tell them. And that would be, like, they would be distraught. I've met many people, like, on the street who would literally start crying in front of me, like, we can't do this. So we put something on the Facebook to help people understand what had happened, you know. And I think for us, it actually, we did that to stop embarrassing people or stop upsetting people, because they bring it up. But it was what really, I suppose, struck me is that the amount of friends and family and even customers, whatever, like, that just came out of the blue and said, you know, that happened to us, you know, we lost a child. And it was incredible, and I really got a sense of how people don't talk about it, and it's a difficult thing to grieve, because you don't have, I suppose, there's a weird sense when you lose a child during a pregnancy, because you've never met them, but you miss them.
Mm.
And then there's a sense of, like, can we grieve this? You know, is it a real thing? Because you don't have any memories. Like,
and is there, is there a burial?
Well, yeah, we went in, I mean, like, I often say the hardest thing I ever had to do was carry a coffin under my arm. Like, it's like something that small is really awful. And we went to the crematorium, and I think like, we did it between ourselves, which, looking back, is probably the wrong thing to do. Like, we just went, the two of us, and we went through the cremation and then went to a place in Meath called Lochcrew, which is like it's kind of like Newgrange, but a bit more run down, I suppose. But it's a beautiful place, and we scattered the ashes there, and that's where his ashes are.
Yeah.
So it's, but I think as time goes by, you kind of realise, and I always make the effort extra with people that I meet if they've lost kids, to let them talk about it and let them understand. Because from my perspective and from our perspective, myself and my wife, that, like, he was a child, and we should grieve that child, and mm. we're allowed to do that. And when we have encountered people that have been in similar situations, the relief you see in them when you acknowledge that they had a baby is really important, I think.
Yeah. We had Kim Marsh on the telly the other night, and she had a stillborn, Archie. Mm. And one of her things is that there's no birth cert. So officialdom doesn't recognise the fact that Archie existed.
You know? Yeah.
And that's a big thing for her, you know.
It's small things like that. And yeah. I mean, it's a difficult thing to get around. Most of the time we try not to upset people about it, but it's how do you, I suppose, qualify it, and then where does it stand in the rankings of, like, is it better if they had it grown to five and then passed away? And you found yourself in these really weird conversations in your head about that. But I think, it's a difficult thing to deal
with. And Dallin, I've never come across that name before.
So Dallin, actually, it's an interesting... Dallin was a poet, I believe, from Donegal, so it's an Irish name.
Right.
Yeah, and so we've... Oscar, obviously, my wife was, and myself, we fancied ourselves as Oscar Wilde enthusiasts when we were students. Probably not true, but... and then they have a sister, Bowen, as well. So it was three Irish names anyway, so it keeps the...
Dallin. Right, yeah.
D-A-L-L-A-N.
Right.
Yeah, I think there was there was two born in Ireland the year he was born, I think, so.
Yeah. So you found solace in running then? Is that too simplistic or is that the way it happened?
I think a lot of this came about, I suppose, or I end up talking about this a lot because of Peter Varga at the Humans of Dublin, because he came to talk to me about, you know, the Instagram thing that he does, and said, we want to feature you in this. And I talked for about 2 hours about coffee and just happened to mention this thing. And I think at the time, like, we went to see the bereavement counsellor, and I think with anything to do with mental health is that I think I'd be very slow to say to people, this is what you should do, because it's different for every people. And I found that going and talking to a bereavement counsellor, for me, I mean, she was really good, I'm sure it works for lots of people. For me, I didn't really get much from it, you know. And I was with the business being busy at the time and a lot of these things happening, and then trying to actually rationalise what it was that I was grieving. I was really struggling, you know. And I remember one day just like... picking up my stuff and just going out the doors and running. And I came back, and it was the first time I was like, I haven't been looking at my phone, I haven't been thinking about anything else, just where am I going to put my feet, you know, and that was it. And then a friend of mine lives down in Naas by the canal, and I said, you know, well, I tried the thing that you do, the half marathon up at Wicklow.
Deborah Ireland,
which is a wonderful thing, but I was just nowhere near able for it. So I think I walked 3/4 of it. So canals was something good for me because it's soft under the feet. You're out in the wilderness. It's in a straight line.
It's flat.
And it's flat. And also, you don't need a map.
So you started. I've never heard of canal running, but maybe you invented it.
Yeah, well, it's brilliant. Well, it was funny though, because like all things, I decided I was brilliant at it very quickly. So we did 5K one Saturday, did 10K the next Saturday, and then the third Saturday we did 15. And I texted my friend. I said, I was just googling how long this thing is, and it's 3 marathons to Galway. And he was like, so is it? Why don't we run it? So the next week we did 20K, and then I think we started the planning, and then at that stage, as long as I'd ever run was 20K, but I called a friend of mine and I said, we're going to rent a camper van, you're going to drive it, and you have to follow us along the canal, and we're going to run this thing.
Yeah.
So with little to no experience, we set off. We started at our shop on Grand Canal Street, and which is, I suppose, the entrance into the canal, and off we went to Galway, and running became that kind of like...
And is it public the whole way? Is there a towpath the whole way, or...?
It is. It's different. Sometimes it's you know, very modern cycle paths and all that kind of stuff. And the thing you have to be careful about is what side of it you run on. So there is towpaths that are apparently hundreds of years old, you know, and they're very beautiful and all. But like, if you run the wrong way on the wrong side of the canal, you'll get to a point where you'll hit a dead end.
It just stops, yeah.
And you might have to go back 8 kilometres to cross over the bridge and come back again. So you have to plan it in advance, so you can do that on Google Maps.
Uh-huh.
But it's wonderful. Like, you just, it's great for keeping, well, I found it great for keeping my head clear. And I don't know, it's.
What happens when you run?
Well, there's a lot of pain.
No, I know, but in your head, I know.
It's the bit. I used to actually. It's funny because as the business growing, I don't really get to make coffee in the shop anymore. And I used to get the same sense when there was a queue out the door, and the docket list full of all these orders to make, and you don't realize what you've done for the last hour. You get the sense of like flow, and I get that from running. Now, if you go for running for like, if we ran 50k in a day the first day or 55 or something, and you might get the sense that like. Yeah, there might be a bit of pain, a bit of arguing, a bit of, you know, laugh, whatever. But every now and again, you'd hit this slipstream where, like, and I remember in particular, we were outside, I think it was we were in Offaly somewhere, what's it called? Edenderry. And the bog is raised there, or the canal is raised above the bog. And there was, I mean, all sorts of bird life and wildlife, you know, floating around, and it was a beautiful sunny day. And it was like a pendulum. Like, it was like...
Yeah. Hit your stride.
And you're like, we didn't speak for like 2 hours. You just clipped, you know, just the whole way, you know, and we covered great distance. And at the end of it was like, did you feel that? Like, that was unbelievable, you know? And like, there was a lot of downsides on it as well on that run. Like, by the time I got to the end, my feet looked something out of a Popeye film.
You're still running and you're going to do this again.
I have this weird thing where I always stop in the summer. I don't know. And then it gets cold again. I'm like, well, if I can run in the winter, I'll run all year round, you know. But over, I think March now, we're going to tackle the Royal Canal because that's been sitting there, you know.
And you're doing it for who?
Well, the last time we didn't do it for anything. We just did it for the crack of it, you know. And then this year, I've actually been trying to raise some money on the side for the maternity hospital. Through just doing speaking events and some... what do they call it, influencer work. So I just say, well, this is the money, give it to the GoFundMe thing. So that's up at about 10 grand on that at the moment, which has been great. So we'll probably do it for that next March. And then put a bit of meat behind it and give it a cause. And then, like, in a weird sort of way, like Hollis we looked after so well when Oisin passed away, and obviously with the three kids that we have, that it's nice in some small way at least to come back and to do something in his memory for them, you know.
Yeah. And everybody's healthy and happy.
Thankfully, yeah. They're like, it's great, you know. It's hard to believe that it's only been 7 years since they've all started to rock into our lives, but it's and you can't go back.
What about Oisin, Dallan's birthday? Is that a bittersweet occasion?
It is, yeah. Like, I think it's funny because you'd forget it for a while, and then sometimes I'd catch him looking in the mirror, and I'm like, and for a second you can see two of them, and you go, God, yeah. Because they would have been identical, you know. And it's difficult because there's times, like the time we found out that they're going to be twins, and then the time that we found out the bad news, and then the time when we found out that Oisin had passed away.
Anniversaries of all those, yeah.
And all of a sudden your whole year is stretched out with all these dates in front of you, you know. So it's difficult, but I think you find ways to deal with it. But like I said, it's dealing with losing a child during pregnancy is something I think in general we should talk about more. And I think
you're right. I think you're right. And your description of how people are awkward around it. If we talk more about it, to be less awkward.
Yeah.
On a completely different topic. The Irish rugby team in Japan have your coffee with them.
They do.
And they have a coffee machine that you recommended, which they're bringing from hotel to hotel. Is that correct?
Yeah, so Kian Healy is a friend of the show, as they say, and has been... He's been coming to us for a long time, and he'll always have feedback on coffees and the interest in different machines and stuff. And like, I mean, it's easy to look at a rugby player and say these lads are meatheads, but Kian Healy, like when he gets into something, he needs to understand everything about it. So he came to our roastery, we trained him how to set up a machine because our machines won't work over there. And so he trained him how to set it up, and we sent them off at 50 kilos. And a friend of mine in Japan who has the same machines wired for Japan sent the machine to his hotel. Now, when he turned up to set it up, Kian already had it rocking. Like he knew exactly he was doing. So
there you go. So if we do really well, you'll be taking credit. It was my coffee, you'll be saying.
I'm happy to make a speech on behalf of the team, right? Yeah, so.
Colin, thanks so much. Thanks for the coffee. Thanks for the book. And mind yourself. I might join you. I'm just thinking I might join you on
that
run.
Well, I was thinking when we do get the date in, I'll give you a shout.
Yeah, give me a shout.
We'll see. At least join us for a stretch and we'll keep you updated as we go anyway. So
thanks, Colin.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
And that's it from us for this Tuesday. Mary Wilson's on the way. We're back tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.